Committee will come to order. The date is Tuesday, March 24th, 2009. Senator Bandevere, if you're ready to go with 1324. He needs a copy of the bill. Okay.
Yes,
welcome
ma'am.
To the Higher Education Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment.
To 1324? Okay.
The A1 amendment, which would put the bill in the shape I'd like it in.
Do we have a quorum?
We don't quite have a quorum, so why don't you just assume that we put it on, and we'll put it on as soon as we get a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, are we...
Okay, what are you doing with the amendment?
Okay, the amendment deletes citizen of and inserts... makes the bill apply to resident student as defined in section 136A, which I think is a state grant program, and or a student entitled to pay tuition under a reciprocity agreement executed under this other section. So if you're a resident for tuition purposes, then you would meet the requirements of this bill to qualify for an athletic scholarship.
Okay, so you want to tell us a little bit of the rationale?
Yeah, well, the rationale is we don't have the kind of money we would like to have for scholarships for students, so I think this would focus the opportunities, because we're really about educational opportunities for Minnesota kids, and this would focus our resources more narrowly on Minnesota students, Minnesota residents.
So your point was not so much foreign students, but just students who aren't Minnesota residents.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. The bill was actually drafted by the House author, and I think his intent is the same.
Okay.
But this, mine is certainly to narrow it even more so that we, really what we're after is, I think the best teams are Minnesota kids on Minnesota college teams. Instead of using taxpayer money to supplant, you know, a Minnesota student, if we're going to use that, now this would still allow, I think, most of the schools to continue to do what they're doing. They just wouldn't be able to use state money to accomplish that. So.
Oh, so they could use their own if they had institutional money.
Yes.
To attract, but not, well. I don't know if athletic scholarships, though, are state money.
I believe we heard that, and there, I think someone from Minsky was here. I think they were using about $90,000 is what they told me for part of it.
We do have a quorum, so would someone like to move the A1 amendment for Senator Bandevere?
I would move the A1 amendment.
Senator Coring moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1324. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. I'm sorry, so...
Well, it's my understanding that there is, and I thought someone was here from... going to be here from Minsky that knew those numbers.
So it's just Minsky.
Maybe they're supporting the bill now, so... but I was told that with regard to the hockey team, it was around $90,000 for St. Cloud. That they used in state money for those scholarships.
So I'm puzzled, because what state money would that have been? Would it be state grant? Because non-residents are not eligible for state grants. So you think they used their appropriation for just their general appropriation for scholarships?
I believe that's...
I thought that's all private fundraising.
It is not, according to...
Someone is joining us. Joining you.
Hi. Madam Chair, Morris Kurz, Athletic Director at St. Cloud State University. And just to clarify that point.
What was the last name? Will you spell it?
Kurz, K-U-R-T-Z.
Okay, and what is your position at St. Cloud?
Athletic Director.
Thank you.
At St. Cloud State University.
Thank you, Mr. Kurz.
Just from our institutional perspective, we have a $1.3 million athletic scholarship budget. $90,000 of that is given to us from the administration to pursue our gender equity Title IX initiatives. The remainder is external fundraised dollars. So if that helps, that's just St. Cloud State University.
But you're, Okay, so that would, the 1.3 million is state money?
No.
No.
The 1.3 million, except for the 90,000, is fundraised external dollars. Yeah, only $90,000 from the university, state dollars for, again, to pursue our initiatives with gender equity and Title IX.
And those could be outside the state of Minnesota?
Yes.
So you could be attracting female athletes from outside the state of Minnesota?
Yes.
Senator Vandeveer, did you know that, thank you, why don't you stay there in case there's more questions for somebody from Minsky. Did you know that, I believe in the Minsky system, that if 80% of the students who go to school who are Minnesota residents stay in Minnesota, and of the non-Minnesota residents, 70% stay in Minnesota? So resident tuition has been used as kind of a recruiting tool to draw talent from other states. Of course, now we're in a recession and we're laying off people, but someday we hope we might be back in a, we should be back in a position where we're going to have a workforce shortage.
Madam Chair, resident tuition is not impacted by this. This is, it actually, it, they would qualify for it to be excluded from this exclusion. We're not impacting them, in other words. We're saying that if you qualify for resident tuition, then you qualify to receive an athletic scholarship with state money or without, either way.
Oh, right. Right. But St. Cloud doesn't, they still have the resident, non-resident status at St. Cloud State. It's all the four-year universities do, I believe, except maybe Moorhead and Southwest have resident only. Any other comments from the committee? Senator Wicker. Yes.
Madam Chair, I believe there's some reciprocity agreements in Canada, Manitoba perhaps, but where else internationally do we have reciprocity?
Mm, good question. With Italy, Senator Tomassoni?
No. But the spaghetti and the wine is so good over there, it's kind of like getting reciprocity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
I don't have an answer for that, but I was, while we have Mr. Kurtz, given the athletic programs that you oversee, so that we're talking about one institution right now, St. Cloud, how many student athletes would be impacted by this language? Do you know?
Madam Mr. Chair, Kurtz. Senator, we have 571 young men and women student athletes representing us in 21 sports. 15 are non-U.S. citizens.
And thank you, Mr. Kurtz.
Sam Michelle.
And can you give me a couple examples? I guess we don't have to name names, but the sports they're involved in, the countries that they hail from.
Certainly, Madam Chair, Senator. Ice hockey, golf, tennis, swimming. Countries include Canada, Germany, Poland, Israel.
And currently, those students are eligible for scholarships?
Madam Chair, yes, they are eligible for scholarships. We also know that non-resident tuition can be waived by international students performing so many hours of community service every week. That is something that's available throughout the Minsky system.
So even if we did pass this legislation, you could work around it because you could just declare, you could waive the non-resident tuition.
Madam Chair, without getting into the intricacies of NCAA rules and regulations, it is countable aid under NCAA guidelines. There's countable and non-countable aid, but I think we're more worried about the message that it sends. 1,000 international students from 100 different countries are at St. Cloud State University. I have to believe the University of Minnesota and the other Minsky institutions have similar numbers, and it's been a strong message that we want the diversity and background and cultures of these young people on our campuses, and we're a little worried about the message that this sends out rather than specifics of can we count or can we not.
Senator Vandeveer.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think that that's the intent of this bill, though. I think the message isn't... The message is that we want to focus on our resources on our students. This doesn't prevent them. We certainly welcome students from all over the world or all over the country. You could make the same argument with regard to the state grants program, but the reality is that we have defined who is eligible for Minnesota grant money, and who's eligible for Minnesota resident tuition. And that same logic can applies to who we allow state money to be, could apply to who we allow state money to go to for scholarships. If the schools want to recruit people from anywhere in the country, they can still do that, or the world. Again, this doesn't prevent them from doing it. It just, if it's for athletic scholarships. I mean, the question here is the purpose of the having the college to have a hockey team, or is the purpose of having the college to have an education for students? And yes, the athletics does provide a broader and a good part of a full education for some students, but if it's that good, then we do want it for our kids too, and we would prefer, I think, that if we're going to use state money, that money goes to help Minnesota kids. So it's not a matter of excluding people, it is a matter of focus. And with the amount of money we have today, I think we need to focus.
Well, it does sound like they're using the state money to fulfill a federal mandate. So, I mean, that's, say we shouldn't have a federal mandate, but that's another discussion. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Coach, is that correct? Would that be correct to address you? Or athletic
Kurtz?
Directors?
Yeah. Oh, director.
Morris
Kurtz
would be just fine.
Kurtz. You said that you spend about $1.3 million in scholarships, $90,000 of which is state money. It just seems to me that this would set up game playing, that there is the capacity to do this with the remaining amount of money, less $90,000 anyway, and then it's all fungible, it seems to me. So
Madam Chair, Senator, it would become a shell game that all the institutions would play.
Yeah.
So I think then we are talking about not we're using legislation to not do something that's really very real, and I am troubled by that.
Senator Roebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I certainly understand the intent of Senator Vandeveer's bill. You know, as somebody who had a son who played Division I sports but wasn't in Minnesota, neighbor in a reciprocity state, but it is discouraging that our own coaches have not in the past. They're getting a lot better. Tubby Smith and Coach Brewster at the U of M are looking more in-state now. And after what we saw in the tournaments so far, I can say that some of them should be regretting that they weren't recruiting Minnesota kids more, because the kids playing for North Dakota and some of the other states that have been here have in Kansas have been standout players, overlooked by our own Minnesota coaches oftentimes. And it's very distressing and discouraging, because here we are following these other teams because they have Minnesota kids on them. Mm-hmm. And we're cheering for them. And they could be ours. And so it's, I fully understand why we want to have as many local players as possible and give as many local kids the opportunity to play here, because they sure can go out and recruit all over the world to get a ringer team. You can find five ringer basketball players if you can go through the whole world and do it. But is that what we really want? I mean, that's what you do for the Olympics, but that isn't what you should do for your college community. And so I want to agree with Senator Vandeveer. I don't know if we're going to get at what he's trying to do with this, because there is so little public money in these scholarship programs. Most of that is privately raised. But I share his frustration. And, I might just vote for it to send a message that, hey, let's try and have people from our state at least and at least the surrounding states here, and not be searching the whole world for these outstanding players that will displace our own young people.
Senator Wieger.
Yeah, I'm about ready to vote,
yeah.
But I had a daughter that participated in Minnesota D1 sports, and some of her fellow athletes on the team were international. And I think that enhanced the team. It enhanced her awareness of people across the world and through competition, and I don't think this is a problem.
Is there anyone, Senator Vandeveer, did you want to say something?
Well, I wanted to say that, you know, we've learned some things here, too, and I have in the hearing, and I'm wondering if it would be possible maybe to lay this over and work on it a little bit more rather than just going to vote on it. But if there's more testimony, that would be great. But
is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you very much, Senator Vandeveer, and the bill will be laid over per author request. Oh, the next bill you have is 1388, then? And what are you doing with this bill?
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Senator Corey.
What just happened? We didn't vote on this?
He asked for it to be laid over. He wants to work on it some more.
Okay. You going to work on it some more? Okay. All right. I was just checking to see. It seems at every committee that I'm in and everything's laid over, we never vote on anything. So I was just seeing.
You never vote in any of your committees.
It's always late. Let's lay it over and for possible inclusion. So I might as well just mail in my vote because I'm not even voting. So anyway, I just thought that was what happened.
We're going to vote. We're going to vote today yet.
We are?
Yeah, we're going to vote, actually.
Oh, goody.
we're actually a policy committee right now.
Oh, okay.
We can vote. Senator Vandeveer, 1388.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for accommodating my request on the last bill. 1388 is designed to, you should have an email that's being handed out to you by a constituent. My testifier couldn't be here today. He's on crutches and just recovering from a serious illness. And he was going to testify, but I think we... Do you have the email from him with his testimony?
We do. Yeah, you could just read his email. Do you see anyone here?
You think so? I have a copy of the email. Thank you. Didn't have it memorized. What his testimony is that it's frustrating and time-consuming, costly, and doesn't make any sense that a Minsky employee, if they move around the system, has to reapply at each institution. And what he's suggesting is, and what the bill encourages, I think originally it was a mandate, but it encourages Minsky to develop a system where when you've applied and been a employee at one campus, that they have central access to that information because the constituent believes that this would lead to higher efficiency, streamline the human services operations, and ease the transfer of employees from campus to campus. And then he describes what an employee has to go through to change. So all this bill does is encourages Minsky to develop a centralized tracking system for employees, which they say would cost money. So
I'm surprised that they don't already have this. Was there someone from the Minsky HR system who's here? Great. Welcome to the committee, and just state your name for the record.
Gary Janikowski, I'm System Director for Human Resources with Minsky.
Okay.
We have reviewed this, and we're fine with it. In fact, we have begun some processes which would do exactly that. Currently, we do have information sharing on most benefits, such as for insurance and retirement plan eligibility and continuation of those benefits. And we've recently also have a new software system called NeoGov, which would do that applicant tracking function that is being discussed. So we're in the process of doing it, but we're not there yet. Okay. But we are supportive of what it says.
Okay, any questions from members of the committee? Anybody else in the audience who wants to comment? Okay, Senator Coring and Senator Vandeveer, you have two choices. If the bill is moving on its own in the House, we could pass it out and send it to the floor. If the chair of the House committee, I believe, is going to have a policy article in the omnibus bill, so I'm not sure if he's moving things out individually. So we could vote to include it in the policy article of the omnibus bill, or we could do both.
Well, Madam Chair,
so dual track.
I would think keeping or voting it into the omnibus bill would be the best of all situations.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would so move that, what's the bill number?
1388.
1388 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion.
Members, if we don't have a controversy around this bill, why don't we just put it in the omnibus?
Okay,
bill?
Sounds good.
Yay. Senator Lynch.
Oh, Madam Chair, I don't want to burst your bubble, but yes. Madam Chair and Senator Vandeveer, I feel like this is micromanaging. I feel like this is a discussion or a point to bring up more appropriately with the board, the Minsky board, and with administration. And I don't feel that this is legislative
and equity
policy or directive. I think this is not necessary.
Senator Lynch, I understand what you're saying. Sometimes it's nice to have things in an omnibus bill that aren't 100% necessary. Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, I agree with that point.
Mr. Albrecht has just pointed out something to me. The increased efficiencies and equity for faculty and staff. What do you mean by and equity?
I don't know.
That's
maybe
a purpose statement, and I would just move to strike that.
Okay.
Yeah.
To take up the whole phrase.
The whole phrase on 1.7.
Senator Roebling moves to delete on line 1.7 up to the comma, including the comma. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then make a capital the. The Board of Trustees is encouraged to place a priority. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Oh, Senator Vandeveer, is that okay?
That's fine with me, thank you.
Wait, just take out your purpose statement. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, any other comments or questions? Senator Lynch, you're free to vote, however you want to vote. Okay, Senator Coring renews his motion to incorporate Senate File 1388 as amended into the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Vandeveer,
you
got one out of two.
Finally.
Senator Tomassoni. Well, members, I thought we weren't going to be meeting on Thursday unless we didn't finish the agenda today, but now we do have the Office of Higher Education's bill to hear on Thursday. So we're not under pressure to finish today. We don't want to. So keep talking. Keep chatting. Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 1315 is a bill that is provides an individual income tax refundable credit for payment of principal and interest on student loans. And Madam Chair and committee members, we all know what's been going on as far as tuition goes and opportunity for kids to get education and why we need education and why it is the way to go. But at the same time, paying the cost is becoming prohibitive. And what this is an attempt to help kids who have graduate from college actually be able to handle the debt load that they're getting. The cost of college has gone up exponentially over the last 10 years at least. And I know at one point in time, 2003, the state's share was 2/3 and it was 1/3 student. Now it's about 50-50, and kids are graduating from college and they owe the equivalent of a mortgage, but they don't own a house. And I think that in many cases what's going to end up happening is that they're going to be paying off their student loans when their kids start college. And I'm not sure what kind of effect that's going to have on the economy in the very near future, but anything we can do to alleviate that problem is something we should try. And so I got a couple of people with me that would like to give you their personal hands-on experience and tell you why this is a really good idea.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Yep. My name is Ryan Kennedy. I am a student at the University of Minnesota. I'm also an intern with the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. And this is a bill that we've been working on. It's actually based off a bill that passed Maine's legislature in 2007. That bill was entitled Opportunity Maine, and we're using the name Opportunity Minnesota to go forward with this bill. And like Senator Tomasoni said, we have problems with people going to school and then graduating with extreme amounts of debt. And as a student, this is something an issue that really resonates with me. And we're looking for creative solutions on how to kind of get rid of this debt, or at least find ways to help students manage it. As you can see, I don't know if we have a fact sheet here that says the...
Do you have copies for us?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Carl will pick them up for you.
Thank you.
And two-thirds of Minnesota students graduate college with debt, and that average debt is $21,000. That's an extreme amount of debt, and this bill, what it does is a creative solution. It allows for, once the student graduates from college, if they stay in the state and work, the state would essentially give them a tax credit for the repayment of their student loans. So if they graduate with their subsidized student loans, whether it be Stafford subsidized loans, Perkins loans, or the federal direct subsidized loans, they would, when they graduated, have a repayment schedule of at least 8 years, and then they would get the tax credit for the repayments they made that year. So essentially, it's allowing them to start contributing to the economy sooner. It's not burdening them with large amounts of debt. It's allowing them to, not have to put off decisions that they would otherwise be making, buying a house, getting married, taking a job that they really want to do, not one that pays more money that they don't necessarily want to do. And so that's really the backbone of this bill. Like I said, it passed Maine's legislature in 2007. They're just getting off, I believe, their first year. They're in their second year of implementation right now. And it passed their legislature overwhelmingly. And so we think that there's support here. We think that not only does this help students, but it helps our economy because it creates a more educated workforce. It kind of incentivizes low-income students to say, well, the barrier that was here for me before, the barrier of $20,000 worth of debt isn't there anymore because I know that I can receive this tax credit and I can go on living my life, without having to kind of look over my shoulder and see, debt collectors or whoever.
Mr. Ryan, does the Maine program use the tax credit as the way to pay it back, or do they just pay for the loan out of some other source of money?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair,
I called you Mr. Ryan. Mr. Kennedy, sorry. You probably get that all the time.
Madam Chair, we took Maine's bill language and just transferred over here and made a few changes. But essentially, this is the exact same program that Maine implemented.
They use the tax credit.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, and were you going to comment?
I didn't know if you had more.
No, I'm good.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Josh Winters, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, or MPIRG. And, just had a few comments to add to the testimony that Ryan just provided. First, I just want to, for the committee, acknowledge the important leadership role that Ryan has played in advancing this piece of legislation forward. I think it is worth acknowledging that he's a senior at the University of Minnesota and basically took it upon himself to launch this initiative and find a way to create a solution to the higher education debt that students face here all across the state of Minnesota. So first, I wanted to acknowledge that. Secondly, MPIRG is a statewide, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. We have 40,000 dues-paying students across the state. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and one of the unique things about the organization is that we are entirely student-directed. And so students like Ryan taking the initiative make the work that we're doing here today possible. I would say that since we've launched this campaign and have been working with our students on the 8 chapter campuses, official MPRG chapter campuses that we have, there's been a dearth of student interest around this legislation and finding some solution to the very real debt burdens that they see coming out of a higher education institution. And I would add rather quickly that almost none of us really expect that, including myself, because I have plenty of higher education debt as well, that this is going to benefit us. I mean, by the time that we would think this passed, and now if we were successful this year, wonderful. We do recognize the difficult budget considerations that you have to weigh. And I'll get to that issue in just a minute. But to say that students do it because they want future generations of students to enjoy a higher education, to create better incentives for people to go get a higher education who perhaps otherwise wouldn't, and provide some relief from the debt burden that they're that's very real in front of them as they look to graduate college, especially in these economic times. So absolutely, we want to ease that burden of higher education debt for future generations. We also look at this as a workforce development piece. I mean, we are I think the comments I've heard here at the state legislature and otherwise is it's not the weather, right, that brings folks to Minnesota, but when we get them here and keep them here, they tend to stay here because they see the quality of life that, that they enjoy here. And here is another incentive to add to the quality of life that we have here in Minnesota. I also wanted to briefly address the fact that I believe this is a critical investment in these economic times. And I really would encourage the committee to look at this as an investment. I know this is the policy committee, but fundamentally it is about a tax credit to offset that debt burden. And the reason we view it as an investment, one piece we haven't talked about, is in Maine's economic analysis, and we're a little bit further behind than we wanted to be working with a professor at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. Currently, he's already stated that from a cost-benefit perspective, the bill is 30 to 50 times to one cost to benefit. And that's a huge benefit to this state from just implementing this program. Also, to the second piece, Maine had done an economic analysis where the program itself had paid for itself on a year-to-year basis by year 3, and by year 7, had they had the analysis indicated they would recoup their benefits from the first 3 years and overall pay for itself on a year-to-year basis. So we anticipate, based on our conversations with the economists, that we're going to see a very similar timeline here from Minnesota. And so I just really want to accentuate that here as we look towards higher education debt relief, workforce development, that in the long run, if we take that long-term look at this bill, it's going to pay for itself.
So it applies, though, to any post-secondary educational institution?
That is correct.
And so a student could graduate, and the very year out of they graduated, they could use this refundable credit?
For however many years they were in college. So, for example, if I'm...
The entire amount of their college debt that first year?
No.
I got it. Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Kennedy.
Like Josh was saying, so if it, it's capped at there's a state statute that is referenced as far as the tuition amount, it's roughly the amount of tuition at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. If you go to a public school in the state, any school in the Minsky system, 4-year, 2-year, or any school in the University of Minnesota Twin Cities system, or the University of Minnesota system, excuse me, then you would have your full amount of tuition would be able to be covered if you took out that much in subsidized loans. If you went to a private school, say you went to McAllister, it would only be covered for the first $12,000, I think is roughly what the statute says, per year. And also if...
When you say the statute said, are you talking about your bill?
No, I'm sorry. There's a statutory reference in our bill. I don't
line,
know.
Line 2.2, Madam Chair.
2.2,
yep.
Okay.
And so that's what we're referencing as far as tuition. And to the best of my knowledge, it's very close to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities tuition. So
around $10,000.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add one last quick
right.
point and just
up
wrap
to.
It up. That's is, you know, and the other thing we've added in here is a piece where there are some businesses in Minnesota who also provide this as a benefit to the employees that work there. And the option under this bill would be that the business could take it or the student could take it, but
that's
only
one.
And so there are certainly, we would submit to the committee that there are a number of businesses that might also benefit from this. And again, we think this sets the stage for Minnesota to retain a strong, educated workforce and carry us into the rest of the century.
Senator Tomasoni and your witnesses, why not allow an individual to take the credit against their loan payments instead of, you know, you might limit the impact on the state budget, but yet you're still if you allow that payment, loan payments are, let's say they're for 10 years, and you'd have to remain a resident of the state. Mm-hmm. So that if you did leave the state, then you would no longer have forgiveness of the loan payments.
Madam Chair, that's how our system works. If you take the tax credit, and please correct me if
against your loan payments. I thought you were taking the tax credit against your entire debt.
Madam Chair, it is only the repayments you've made for a year. So if your first year out of college, you would only get the tax credit
for you owe $2,000
for that year.
Loan payments for that year.
Yep, you would only be able to take the refundable tax credit for the $2,000, and then the next year you would still have to remain in the state to get your next $2,000. And for year three, you'd have to remain in the state still to get your next $2,000.
I mean, you could prepay. Senator Cornyn.
Madam Chair, I guess I don't understand it. So tax credit. So you would, if you're out in the workforce, and you would just be a $2,000 credit on your taxes,
mm-hmm.
or how would it work?
Is that,
Madam Chair, Senator
Mr. Kennedy?
Yes, that is how it would work. For example, if you owed $2,000 in subsidized student loan repayments for that year, then yes, you would get essentially a $2,000 refundable tax credit for that year.
So it's only subsidized student loan repayment. It's not credit card debt or anything else that you might have incurred while you're in college.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And is there anything to prevent you from prepaying? You're using the system to prepay your debt so you could pay it all in the first year?
Madam Chair, yes, there is. It has to be 8 years. 8 years is the minimum amount of time. So.
Where does it say that?
One second.
Well, that's what we're trying to determine. He said it should be.
Madam Chair, can I ask a
Senator
question?
Senator Cornyn, please.
Madam Chair, and so then let's say a hypothetical that you're out and you're working. And you, let's say I paid in $1,500 in taxes, and then I get the $2,000 credit, I only get $1,500 back? Is that, I guess I'm
Ask
still
them.
Not following.
I'm confused. Mr. Kennedy?
Madam Chair, Senator Cornyn, if I understood your question correctly, it was if you paid $2,000, but you only owed $1,500 in taxes, you're saying that you would only get $1,500 back. Was that your question?
Fees, which is tiny,
huh? Madam Chair and Senator Mr. Cornyn. Kennedy, what I'm saying is, let's say that particular year I only paid in $1,500 in taxes,
mm-hmm.
and you're saying that you get a $2,000 tax credit. I couldn't get $2,000 credit on my taxes because I didn't pay in $2,000. And so I guess I'm still kind of puzzled.
Senator Cornyn, it's refundable. So even if you didn't pay that in, you still get it. You'd still get it, right?
Okay.
That's why it seems to make more sense to have it a phase-in. It'd be less likely to be refundable if it was a phase-in. Except maybe it still might be the first couple years you're out of college. But I don't see where it says the 8 years in here, Mr. Kennedy.
Madam Chair, I was referencing Maine's bill language. It has just come to my knowledge that it was not included when we had Maine's bill language transferred into our language.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members, we would be amenable to any amendment the committee would desire. The committee would desire to make. It is our intent to have that on there. It's not our intent to have the situation you described.
So it's like over 8 years maximum. Minimum.
Yeah. Minimum.
I would say minimum.
Yeah. Minimum. So is that usually the extent of a student loan is 8 years? Is that why that was picked?
Yeah. You can go for about 100 years.
100 years.
Yeah.
Well, do you know why 8 years was picked or 10 years? Or
8 years is plenty long.
It's kind of arbitrary.
Madam Chair, that was the number that Maine picked. I don't know their reasoning in picking eight, but our intent was really to transfer the program over from Maine with minor changes.
Yeah.
And
if the standard is more 10 years, maybe we should check into that, and mm-hmm. we could just do that, 10
sure.
years.
Sure.
Okay, then another issue that's come up is under maximum qualifying amount, mm-hmm. there's a difference between two and four year. Maybe they should be the same. Why do you have a differential?
Madam Chair,
Dr. Kennedy.
Because the program covers for bachelor's degrees and associate's degrees.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that was the reason for that difference. So then you couldn't claim 4 years worth of subsidized student loans if you only got an associate's degree. If that might be not.
And you have to have graduated.
Correct. You have to have graduated.
Oh, so you're not even eligible if you drop out.
Correct.
That's good.
Madam Chair, also, possibly because the tuition at a two-year college might be less than the tuition at a four-year college. Is that possible?
Madam Chair, members, that's what I was going to suggest as well. It's the tuition difference between a two-year college and a four-year college. And part of what you want to do, it seems to me, is just make sure there are some reasonable limits on how much an individual could claim in the tax credit over the duration of the repayment of the loan.
And, Madam Chair, I think...
Senator Tomasoni.
I think I haven't read the main proposal, but we have done some things on the Iron Range in regards to trying to recruit doctors and dentists. And the number of years was key to getting people established. And once people got established in the state, and generally speaking, we thought it would take 5 or 6 years for them to get established, then they wouldn't want to leave. Whereas if they only stayed for 1 or 2 years, it's easy for them to pull up stakes and go to a different state and take a different job. So I think the eight-year reason, or 10 years, whatever you want to do, mm-hmm. is a good way to get people to say, if you still want to keep getting the credit for your student loans, you still have to keep working in the state.
Right.
Are we meeting in policy committee?
Yeah. Okay. Senator Tomasoni, I don't think we need the language on 2.26 and 2.27. I don't think that would be appropriate in the tax committee, because they're the ones who are going to be appropriating the money. Yeah, we're going to send it to tax,
okay.
But we don't need that language.
Oh,
we don't usually put that in.
Okay.
Senator Tomasoni moves to delete 2.26 to 2.27. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Do we want to put a year number?
Yeah, Senator Tomasoni, there's no hurry with this because it's going to tax committee. So can we just lay it over and bring it up on Thursday?
Absolutely.
And then it would give the staff a little bit more time to look at it. And then if you could find that 10-year or 8-year language from the main bill.
Okay.
That would be good. And talk to Mr. Fuller about it.
You can have that.
Okay. But, you know, I mean, I think this is a great plan to help students. And we do have some income limits. You have to have a household income under $75,000. During the whole 8 years, okay. So if you go to law school and you graduate and you get a great job, you're not eligible. And still, I want to think about these limits on 4 year and 2 year. Did you have any other issues, Mr. Fuller?
Refundable
is a deal, right? Whether we want to do refundable, right? Yeah.
You get dollar back.
Is this an incentive for more borrowing? Rather than less, you know? I mean, kind of think about that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Winters.
That is one of the considerations that we've had and mm-hmm. willing to debate it here in committee and see what makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think our key, again, is to at least get at the principle of what we're trying to do. But, we don't want to sort of create that moral hazard there, so to speak, that
right.
people would take out larger loans than they would otherwise need to. I want to add really quick, if I may.
Students even think
we do
that.
Have some of the analysis that was done in Opportunity Maine. Should any of the committee members desire to see it,
yes.
I do have copies.
Yes. Do you have that with you now?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and pass that out so we can look at that. Okay, then we'll just lay the bill over, and we'll bring it back on Thursday.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Stanton, if you would like to just come forward and present the two bills, and then when Senator Sharon comes back, I'll... Oh, she's right there. Then I'll just turn over the gavel to you for the rest. You can pass it. Well, maybe just wait till Thursday. Just make sure I look
at the agenda.
Okay.
Which is first? Which one first?
Why don't you take Senator Olson's bill?
Okay.
1267. These pension bills haven't usually come to higher ed, but they probably should, so we can at least know what's going on.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm Russ Stanton, Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. That's the state university faculty unions, and this bill would affect us and the community college faculty. That's who would affect the most. House file, or Senate file 1267 would allow is faculty members who are in the individual retirement account plan to voluntarily switch to the teacher's retirement or TRA plan within 1 year after reaching tenure or its equivalent. If a faculty member decided to switch to TRA, he or she would have to buy back all of their years of service under IRAP and to pay the full actuarial cost of the buyback themselves. As background, currently all faculty members who begin work in MNSCU are placed in the IRAP plan. The IRAP plan is a defined contribution plan. It stands for Individual Retirement Account Plan, as their basic pension plan. They have an option within their first year of service to switch to TRA. However, only about 15% of the two-year faculty and about 10% of the state university faculty do exercise that option to switch to TRA. The vast majority stay in IRAP. And the reason they stay in IRAP is because IRAP is very portable. If you change jobs, you take the employer and employee share in your interest. It's just like an IRA. You just take it, or a 401k or whatever. You just take it with you. In higher education, unlike the K-12 sector, we have an awful lot of very short-term faculty members, adjuncts, fixed-term appointments, community faculty, customized trainers, and so forth. And so having that portability option is very important when they first start work.
Because if you didn't have that and you didn't stay long enough to be vested, you would just lose.
You just lose the employer share. TRA gets to keep it. The employee loses it.
Well, TRA is a little underfunded, so maybe that.
Well, I'm sure it would make TRA happy, but this plan will too. Mm-hmm. Some faculty, and it's a fairly small percentage, would like the option to switch to TRA once they reach tenure. Because once they reach tenure, their employment is far more secure and portability is far less of a factor. And in addition, many of these faculty are risk adverse. And in TRA, absorbs all the risk of investment risk. The faculty member doesn't do investment. They get their benefit at retirement based on a formula. The bill does not cost MNSCU anything. The buybacks would be paid for entirely by the faculty member doing the buyback. This legislation was introduced last year, and TRA at that time had some concerns about what kind of impact it might have on TRA's funding. And so we put a provision in the pension bill last year to do an actuarial study of the issue, and that study came back in January, and what the actuary concluded is that if all IRAP members switched to TRA and bought back their past service at full actuarial value, it would actually have a slightly beneficial impact on TRA's financing. Of course, not all people would buy back, and there is a potential for adverse selection if people are making these decisions. And to guard against adverse selection, we put in several safeguards in this bill. First of all, we limit the switch to when they reach tenure, and that's typically at a state university. That's typically the fifth year. At a two-year institution, that's typically the third year that they reach tenured status or unlimited status. And the reason we did that is because TRA gains the most when people switch when they're young. I passed out a chart that the actuary from the actuary's report that you have, and it shows they basically ran how many, if everybody who could potentially switch, and how many winners there'd be and how many losers there'd be. And if you limit it to 5 years or less, there'd be TRA would gain in about 1,200 of the cases and lose in about 600 of the cases. So it would be a net winner, particularly for TRA, if you limit it to that. Because of that limitation, TRA is supportive of the bill. If we threw it wide open, they would not be supportive of the bill. So that therefore, we did restrict it to that. Secondly, we put a five-year sunset in the bill. So in case if studies show that there is adverse selection developing, they could always stop it. And third, the bill requires the people who are switching to pay the full actuarial cost. And that's actually, if you've been there a long period of time, that's a huge amount of money. And usually what I've found is when people see how much that the true actuarial cost is, they usually back away from it if they're a long-term employee.
Because they wouldn't have that money necessarily already in their IRAP.
Correct. And short-term faculty, typically the cost isn't nearly as much, and so it's much more feasible for them. So in summary, this bill would provide an attractive new alternative option for faculty when they reach tenure. It doesn't cost the employer anything and would probably improve TRA's funding. We've worked with TRA on the issue. They're supportive of the legislation as it is. We've worked with Minsky. They're supportive of the legislation, and both of the faculty unions are in support of the legislation.
Okay, so. Any questions from the committee? Senator Roebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I just find this interesting because do you remember the pre-69 group that was really, it wasn't higher ed faculty, but it was K-12 faculty,
mm-hmm.
and they were upset because they had not had the option to go into an IRAP type of program, which was more dependent upon the stock market, which performed extremely well during the 90s. And the people who had gotten that option had gotten much better return on their retirement than the people who were in the defined benefit. And now this is flipping it around because now the stock market, of course, is not doing well. But if they choose this, I just want to warn them that there is no going back.
Yes, I agree.
I mean, because, the stock market could start performing extremely well again, and then they'll be sorry that they're in a defined benefit, and we don't want a group of them coming here like this other group did and say, this was a bad deal for us. We should, we aren't getting nearly the retirement benefit that the other ones did. And so it all depends on what the market's doing.
Senator Roebling, the Pension Commission is actually trying to separate benefit increases from market actions so that it's more increases are more based on cost of living. So you get a COLA, to preserve the buying power of your pension, but you don't get an increase based on market.
And Madam Chair.
Which, of course, then people like when the market's doing bad because then they don't get a decrease, mm-hmm. which you hardly ever can do with pensions anyway. I don't think it's constitutional.
Right. And that is something that I had advocated for a long time is to put the cap on the annual cap because we had years when those retirement benefits were seeing 11% increases.
Right.
And now
TRA is at 2.5%. Right. That's their cap.
It's not sustainable anymore. Mm-hmm. The thing I'm concerned about is if the TRA fund does not do well and requires an infusion of cash at some point, it's going to end up coming from the state, from the active employees. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little worried about putting more people in there, especially during a time when I don't think that they're showing that they're fully funded. And so that's my only concern. I realize it's not going to cost Minsky any money now, but at some point it could cost their active employees more money and the state, which matches their increased contribution, it could cost them more money. And I don't know. I almost wish that the Pension Commission would deal with this because they have more experience.
They are. This is going to go to state and local, and it's already actually been heard by the Pension Commission and approved. But it was, it's a good idea for us to hear it, too. So that TRA is supportive. They, paying the full actuarial value is kind of key for them, if I could say that word.
Could I ask Mr. Stanton?
Yes, Senator Roebling.
When we're talking about filling in the gap for employees that have already been in the other plan for a while, can they take their IRAP money and use that to fill their to make up the difference?
To pay the actuarial cost?
Right.
Yes. In fact, that's one of the things in the bill is to allow them to do that. And there's a real advantage to allow them to do that rather than use cash from the outside because it's pre-tax dollars. And so tax-wise, it's a much better deal than using after-tax dollars to do the buyback. Is it controversial yet? And it's allowed under IRS law.
Does anyone in the audience want to testify on this? I forgot to ask that on Senator Tomasoni's bill. You'll have to remind me. Does anyone want to move to send this bill to state and local government where it would be included in the pension bill? Senator Wieger moves that Senate File 1267 be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Corrin missed his chance to vote again. Then, as long as you're there, Mr. Stanton, you want to just explain the other bill?
Yes. Madam Chair, members, Senate File 1266 is an early separation incentive authorization for MNSCU. The bill allows the MNSCU Board of Trustees to offer targeted early separation incentives to MNSCU employees. The incentive could either be cash or a contribution to the post-retirement health care savings plan, which is just like a savings account for state employees, or a combination of the two. The type of incentives that they offered could vary by the employee classification as determined by the board. It would be up to the president of each college or university or the chancellor in the case of statewide employees to designate the specific departments, programs, or in this bill, even down to specific positions that would be eligible for the incentive. The decision to offer the incentive could be unilateral on the part of the employer. In other words, they wouldn't have to bargain it. And a decision not to offer it could not be grieved. The decision to take the early separation incentive would be voluntary on the part of the employees, and that's federal law. And there is no appropriation connected to this bill. Any incentive that must be paid by the college or the university granting the incentive or by the chancellor in case of system-level employees. There is an annual report required to the Board of Trustees that oversees MNSCU and the types and number of incentives granted, and that has to be public, filed with the legislative library, et cetera. Finally, there's a sunset again after 5 years to force a reevaluation of the program. In terms of why the bill, as you well know, we're headed into some very rocky financial times in the state. And these are rocky times that are likely to last for not just this biennium, but probably well into the next biennium. And we're likely to see lots of non-renewals and perhaps layoffs of within MNSCU in the years ahead. A common tool in the private sector is to use early separation incentives. I know in not far from where I live in Richfield, the Best Buy just offered 3,000 of their employees early separation incentives as part of their reorganization plan. The value to higher education of our early separation incentive like this is that when you downsize, you can save almost twice as much money by retiring out a senior faculty member as you can by laying off a young faculty member that just started. And the savings can be used to pay for the incentives and often lead to net savings. It also, in higher education, it takes more time to lay off, for instance, a tenured faculty member. And with a separation incentive, you can do that much faster. There's also real morale benefits. The young faculty member goes away happy. The retiring faculty member is happy, and MNSCU gets a lot more flexibility in reorganizing. There have been some problems with early separation incentives in the past. The state has offered over a dozen early separation incentives in past years. And in the mid-90s, the legislative auditor did do a report on them and it had some criticisms. And one was that the incentives that had been offered in the past have been across-the-board incentives. Everybody was entitled to them. And the problem with the across-the-board approach to early retirement incentives is you can lose the person that you wanted to keep. And also, some of the people that took the incentive were planning to retire anyhow, so there really wasn't much savings associated with it. To respond to that concern, one of the things we did in this bill was to allow the incentive to be targeted, right down to specific positions that they want it to be directed at, so that you get the maximum return on the people that retire. Secondly, some of the incentives that were paid in the past were paid for either by a statewide appropriation or by the pension funds. And the problem with that is the entity granting the incentive was usually different than the entity that paid for the incentive. And so they sometimes gave it away like candy. The people granting it got all the benefits and somebody else paid the cost. And what this important aspect of this legislation is that the entity granting the incentive also has to pay the cost. In designing it, we purposely tried to be non-prescriptive and give Minsky maximum flexibility. I think one of the things that a lot of people do not realize is that one-third of the state workforce works for Minsky. It's a very large, complex organization, many different personnel plans, several different unions that cover that plan. And what's good for one union or one institution might not be good for another. A fast-growing institution like Mankato will have quite a different need than a declining in enrollment or shrinking institution like Bemidji, for instance. So this gives them flexibility to adjust to that. It also has accountability. Unlike most agencies, Minsky has a separate governing board that oversees the president's and the chancellor. There has to be an annual report on what kind of incentives are given. If people are screwing up, they can do something about it. I might point out that the legislation was worked out in cooperation with Minsky.
Does Mr. Jankowski, then, do you want to weigh in from Minsky on?
Sure, Madam Chair. Gary Jankowski with Minsky again. Yes. Mr. Stanton has worked with us on this language, and there were several pieces in here that we were able to cooperatively work out, and we're supportive of the measure.
Okay. Senate Council has found correction on line 2.4. We need to say, or the chancellor.
Oh.
You say that kind of consistently, or the chancellor. Yeah. Sounds right. Someone want to offer that? Senator Tomasoni moves that on line 2.4 after university. Do we need any punctuation there? Nope. Delete the period and insert or the chancellor. Mm-hmm. Period. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. And Mr. Stanton, what is lines 2.5, 2.6, what does that mean?
It means that if they designated, for instance, the department a specific position to get the incentive, and another person in that department was upset that somebody else got the incentive and they didn't, they can't grieve it.
They can't grieve it. Okay.
Correct.
Doesn't mean they couldn't go to court if there was a constitutional issue or something.
Correct. I mean, I think they could always go to court in the constitutional.
Right. Okay. Great, then. Would someone move this for me? Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1266, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Any in the audience want to comment? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Sharon is going to chair, and actually Senate File 184 has been deleted from the agenda.
Okay, Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 274 is putting the language relative to the joint Regent nomination joint committee in the House and the Senate and to be identical to what's in the joint rules. And I'd like to just, there are no questions?
Are there any questions? Is there anyone who wants to, do you have anybody that wants to know of anybody that wants to speak about this or speak to this issue? Seeing no one?
Okay. Then I would move that Senate File 274 be recommended to pass and incorporated into the omnibus bill.
On the motion, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes.
Senate File 1222 is another Regent's bill, and we don't have any limits on how long a member can serve on the Regent Candidate Advisory Council, and there are several members that have served like the entire time of the council's existence, which I think is something like 24 years. And it just seems like, they have imposed limits on the regents. I mean, we don't have any legal limits on how long a regent can serve, but by custom, it's been two terms. So it seemed to me if we're going to have limits on how long regents can serve, we should have limits on how long individuals on the Candidate Advisory Council serve. I thought they had a four-year term because we have four-year terms, but they actually have six-year terms. So I limit them to two full terms, which is 12 years, which I actually wanted to discuss with the members is, do you think that's long enough, or too long, or we can always change the length of their term to 4 years, which might cause a little more drafting. Or since there's no limit now, maybe 12 years is a good number.
On that question, does anybody have any comments? Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I've never been a term limit guy. What kind of feedback have you gotten in regards to people willing to serve on this council?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, we don't have any problems with people serving on the council. We actually have, I'm not going to name any names, but we have some issues around people who've been on the council a long time and tend to dominate because they're the most senior members. And so I think that getting some fresh blood now and then is healthy.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas.
Senator Tomasoni.
That happens in the legislature, too. We're not four-term limits here.
Senator Roebling, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I was just wondering, is it the governor who appoints the people to this?
I think it's a third, a third, a third. A third by the governor, a third by the House, a third by the Senate. And this does say that existing members who have exceeded the 12 years can finish out their term, but then they can't run again, they can't be reappointed again.
Any other questions?
Okay, then I would move that Senate File 1222 be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
On that motion, any further discussion? Anyone wishing to be heard from the general audience? Senator Pappas renews her motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Passes. All right. Senate File 661. Senator Pappas.
Well, it would have been helpful to have my file on this bill, Katie.
Because
this actually is like a complicated bill. Well, we'll just look at the explanation here on Senate File 661 so I can remember what it does. There's a section here I don't know about because it was added in Judiciary Committee.
Senator Pappas, if you have your file, would you that clarify for you? Do you want to take the
not.
Other bill first?
It would not clarify for me.
Okay.
This is Senator Moise. Kara's, is she, maybe she needs to get Senator Moise.
You want Senator Moise language?
It's in here. It's already in here, right? It's in the first and second engrossment. Let's wait and see if we can get Senator Moise to come and explain the University of Minnesota data section.
Very good.
And
we'll move on to 819.
What I'm doing is Oh, that's right. Someone from the U was going to explain this.
So you want it back?
Yes.
All right.
Sorry, I'm so confused, members.
Thank you. Welcome. Would you introduce yourself? To the committee.
Yes, I'm Stuart Mason. I'm the Chief Investment Officer at the University of Minnesota, and I'm responsible for making all of the long-term investments in the long-term endowment to the university, as well as managing all of the short-term cash reserves in various pools across the university. We have introduced legislation on behalf of the university's investments in a portion of the long-term endowment. That legislation would restrict public access under the Data Practices Act to restrict the public access to certain very sensitive business data that is otherwise private that we come into possession of as we are doing due diligence on making initial investments in certain private sectors of the market and on an ongoing basis as we do compliance monitoring of the managers whom we hire to make the investments on our behalf in the private markets. The business data really falls into two categories. First of all, it is private business data about the manager that we are investing with, so the general partner in circumstances where we are the limited partner. And secondly, it is the business data involving the underlying investment, specifics of the underlying investments. In other words, a venture capitalist corporation that we might deal with makes investments in early stage technologies, many of which are not yet patented and so forth. We have all of that data in our files, and it is that data that we would propose to restrict public access to. In many cases, we're also an investor in buyout funds that are doing acquisitions of public companies, so we have public data about mergers that have not yet happened, and we would propose that that is part of the same pool of data that the public or that would be made non-public data. There's a couple of reasons that we seek this legislation. First of all, the private investments that I've just been describing to you are the most successful portion of our long-term endowment. Over the last 5 years, that piece, which this would protect, has produced 30% compounded annually, year in and year out. That contributes approximately $40 to $50 million of new money into the endowment each year. Public stocks, in contrast, produced minus 2% over that period. Public bonds, a safer investment, produced positive 1% over that period. And our hedge funds, which we have only a few of, produced positive 7%. So this is a very, very important piece of the overall investment puzzle. Very consistently over the last 6 or 8 years, the better private investors have systematically eliminated the public universities from their pool of potential investors. We're on that list. The best venture capitalists in the world will not allow us to invest. We have been an investor in probably the best one, Sequoia Ventures, who is the founder of Google, Yahoo, and many of the Silicon Valley great companies, since their founding in 1980. 5 years ago, they, after 13 successive investments in their various funds, they restricted our investment, or they eliminated us from the investment partnership because of our FOIA issues. We are currently in discussions and about to be eliminated by Charles River, which is another very successful founder of Network Systems, Oracle, a number of other companies, tech companies that you'd be familiar with. I have represented to them that if they can hold off until May, we'll have an answer on this proposed legislation and that they're, we are hopeful that maybe we can make progress. The income that's generated, the $40 to $50 million annually, is a primary source at the university for student scholarships, life-saving research. And a third point, which is those investment partners come to Minnesota and make investments here. They recirculate some of the investment money that we and other limiteds invest in those partnerships to advance the economy here in Minnesota. There is legislation, my final point would be, there is legislation currently on the books that was passed in this body about 4 or 5 years ago that gave privileges similar to what we're requesting to the State Board of Investments. In the little handout that I have given you, you'll see there are several categories of information on the right-hand side of the sheet. The top bracket, which includes financial business, proprietary data that may cause competitive harm and so forth, is already excluded from public accessibility by the laws that are on the books for the investments that are made by the State Board of Investments. The last of the three, the information about the specific underlying investments is also currently excluded from public for the State Board of Investments. We are asking that that information plus the four bullet points that are in the center bracket, which include some very specific proprietary data about the individual managers themselves, that that data also be, that we be granted the non-public benefits of that currently accrue to the State Board, as well as the four bullet points in the center bracket. That's the essence of the legislation.
Thank you, Senator Pappas.
And Madam Chair, the only other section that relates to the committee is Section 2, which directs post-secondary institutions. These are public only, though the Minsky, basically, to submit a list of names and addresses of students enrolled at their institution and residing in Minnesota to the Secretary of State. This is so that at each polling place, they will have a list of students that are of resident in that polling place, so that if students come and to do same-day registration, it kind of can further back up the fact that they are residents. And I do have a couple students who are here to, a student who's here to testify is Holly Davis, here from MSUSA. Okay, maybe Holly just wants to come and join us.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Holly Davis, and I'm the Director of Research and Policy for the Minnesota State University Student Association. So I will restrict my comments to Section 2 then?
Yes.
Okay, so.
That's the only student section, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So usually when MSUSA comes before this committee, we're talking about access and affordability, but we also do a lot of work with civic engagement and getting students out to vote. So this fall, as we do most falls where there's an election, our students engage their peers in voter registration, voter education efforts, and also get out the vote. So the students that live in the dorms currently, they're allowed to, you know, when they come to vote, they have their student ID and they're matched to this housing list that's provided at their precinct in the dorms. We're interested, as this proposal does, in expanding this to all students so that they're all provided equal treatment. As I'm on campuses on election day, I often talk to students, and you know they're aware that there's an election coming up, but they never got registered. So they ask me, well, how can I vote today? What do I need? So I'll go through the full list of different options they have with them, but perhaps their driver's license address is at their parents' house and not at their campus address where they like to vote, or they have a utility bill, but it's in their roommate's name, which doesn't do them a lot of good, and maybe they can't find somebody to vouch for them. Whatever the situation is, it's not uncommon that after talking with a student, we simply can't find a way for them to vote on election day, which is, of course, unfortunate. And I always wonder how many of those students will come back the next year or the next election and try and vote, or if they'll just sort of write it off. And of course, you know, we're interested in engaging these students because, well, quite frankly, it's my job. But in a bigger picture, we know that voting is habit forming, and many of these students, this is their first or second election that they're eligible to vote in. And so as they're developing these habits to vote in, we want to engage them and really develop this population of lifelong voters, which, of course, in Minnesota we really pride and value. So generally, you know, students are very excited about this provision.
Thank you.
And this bill has, this section actually was already in state and local government, the whole bill. And the section one has already been in the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering how the colleges keep track of these students as they move around. The dorms are easy, mm-hmm. but this is much more complicated. Some students, I don't know if they ever give the institution anything but their parents' address, because they do tend to move sometimes semester to semester. some of them are sleeping on somebody's couch over here. So they're really hard to track. So how do you propose to do that? Do the institutions, do they always have a local address for all the students, or do a lot of them just have their parents' address?
Ms. Davis?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question, and I don't know the extent. I know that many students, they have an address on file, and you're right, whether it's their parents or a local address, that's always the tricky question. Most of them will have some sort of reference. Hopefully it's up to date from year to year, you know, as they move. But we do know that as we're doing this work, this is sort of, as I mentioned, going down this list of options on election day to be able to go and check, and hopefully this list will be another option and that they will have the correct address. We're also, our organization is going to be working with MinSCU to help make sure this data is good and up to date and encouraging our students to provide their most current address to the institution they attend.
The bill originally, thank you, Madam Chair, the bill originally applied to all post-secondary institutions. The private colleges said we would, had some issues around privacy as well, as did MinSCU, that we would like to continue working with our local county auditor, that we typically provide them a list of our students that are living in the dorms. So they were exempted, and then I'm looking at line 3.21, 3.22, asking the University of Minnesota to also comply and send a list to the Secretary of State.
Any further questions for
Madam Chair?
Senator Wieger and
I'm sorry.
Senator Senjum?
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Davis, your questions?
Madam Chair, yes. Ms. Davis, is this public information?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, there are provisions in here, I believe.
And as you're looking, what if a student doesn't want it made public that they're going to that school? And moreover, in the information highway for anyone to look at?
Yeah.
Maybe they were a victim or.
Thank you.
Ms. Fraser from the Secretary of State can also respond.
Ms. Fraser, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Wieger. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And this is not public data. The current law, which this amends, already makes clear that this data may not be used other than for the purpose of Election Day registration. And I'm trying to find that reference in the bill, but that is already clear.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, Ms. Fraser, Senator, this is not a list that the Secretary of State would sell.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, no, it would just be used for Election Day registration. We would get the list and precinct it and then send it to the appropriate county. Current law allows colleges and universities to submit lists of students on campus and within 10 miles of campus. And not many universities have sent lists of students off campus because it's hard to figure out who's within 10 miles, and some of the counties that do get off campus lists, for example, Blue Earth County, have found that they don't have a way to precinct the list. So what they do is they have to make a copy of the entire list and send it to every precinct in the 10-mile radius because they don't have a way of weeding it down to just the appropriate name. So it's cumbersome and more expensive than need be.
Madam Chair?
Another question, Senator Wieger?
Maybe a couple more where I could yield to Senator Senjum.
Why don't you continue with your thought process and then we'll move over to Senator Senjum.
Thank you. Maybe Ms. Fraser or Ms. Davis, if a student's not eligible to vote, would they have their name forwarded? For example, one that's under 18. We have lots of PSEO students that are attending college. Would their birth date or all persons on that list be indicated? Or if a person is a convicted felon, would that be indicated? And is that correct to do?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, the lists would be handled just as they are now. And so it would include people that probably aren't eligible to vote. But this does not register people to vote. This just provides help, part of a proof of residence for students doing Election Day registration. So the student still needs to come in person, needs to fill out the voter registration form and swear under penalty of perjury that they are 18, that they are a citizen, that they are not a felon. And so just like every other voter, they need to swear under penalty of perjury that they are eligible. And being on this list doesn't waive that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Senator Senjum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe just a question to, and I don't have the name, the Secretary of State designee. Ms. Fraser. If we didn't do this, would that suggest then that let's just say hypothetically, a Rochester student going to University of Minnesota carried a driver's license with a Rochester address, they could not vote at a precinct in at the university. Is that correct?
Ms. Fraser.
Where do they live?
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, it depends where they live, and it's not about whether or not they have the right to vote. It's about providing one more tool to students to assist them with Election Day registration. So,
Senator Senjum, I think that, let me check this out with you, Ms. Fraser, that they may have a driver's license that still has their home address on it, but if they can demonstrate by paying that they're in a dorm or an apartment while they're going to the university, and they can be someone can vouch for the fact that they live there, or they have a bill that indicates they're paying a rent or a lease if they show their lease. Mm-hmm. So it demonstrates that during that time they're living there and they choose to vote there at the university rather than in Rochester. That's allowable under the law. Is that correct, Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, pretty much. Leases aren't allowed. But yes, if they can provide proof of residence, they can vote where they go to school. Students have the choice of voting either where their parents live or where they go to school, depending on which they consider their residence.
Okay, Madam Chair and Ms. Fraser, so as I recall, and I think you've noted, a simple vouching would probably allow you to vote. And if we were to do this, this would further augment or substantiate at least what the residence was. Is that correct? So it's an assist, if you will.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, it's an alternative to vouching. So if none of your roommates can come with you, this allows you to go to the polling place and show your student ID card, and they'll look you up on the list. It means that there will be more students' names on the list who right now aren't on the list.
Madam Chair, may we ask counsel, there was a question about whether or not this was private data only for election purposes. Could Senate counsel confirm that for us to the extent he's able?
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, I perused the bill, and that's the extent of my knowledge, and I looked at page 2, line 32, and it kind of waffled. It says the list, I don't know if this is the list you're talking about, I hope it is, the list must be certified and sent to the, shall include each name and current address as permitted by applicable privacy laws. Well, I don't know what those laws are.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, if you look at lines 3.23 and 3.24, you'll see that current law provides that this list may not be used for purposes other than Election Day registration.
And Madam Chair, I did get some more information that Minsky has stated that this will take an extra waiver process similar
to Davis,
other.
Davis, I just want to make sure you have your name for the record.
Yes, Holly Davis. And Minsky has stated that they are willing to do this. It does take an additional waiver process similar to ones that are already in place. So we'll be working with them this summer. Is that correct? Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Senator Wieger?
Yes, Madam Chair, I noticed that at line 3.21, we humbly ask if the university could comply. And I don't know if Ms. Peterson has any word on that or the author as to whether that would. Okay.
Ms. Peterson responds that they will do it.
Madam Chair.
They may already be doing it. They may just be doing it with Hennepin County.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. We do have another person who would like to testify at some point here. Mm-hmm. Senator Tomasoni.
Chair, to Senator Senjum's point, what if that person that is from Rochester registers at the University of Minnesota and votes and then goes home
and rushes home
and votes in Rochester? How do you control that? How is that controlled?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, that does happen usually once or twice each election. There's sometimes a student, sometimes somebody else who decides it would be fun to trick the system. And what happens is when, after the election, the election day registrations and the voting history is entered, they are caught, they are charged with a felony, and prosecuted for a felony. In 2004, there were a couple students at St. Thomas University that were charged with felonies. One of them wanted to be an attorney, and his dream kind of went down the drain.
Well, Madam Chair, it's good then.
Senator Tomasoni.
It's good then that I didn't tell my kid to do that because he was going to school in Duluth and was going to have to vote for Senator Bach, and I thought he should have been voting for me. But as it turns out now, both of Senator Bach's kids are in my district, so hopefully they're voting for me. So turnabout's fair play.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I actually know a teacher who did this and was caught. And, there's some people just are not too smart.
Senator Pappas and
that
others.
Doesn't include Senator Tomasoni or his son.
He didn't do it. He didn't do it.
Senator Pappas and others, you might help me remember this, but it seems to me there was a piece of legislation that's moving forward. I think it was Senator Latz's that talked about in some place along the way that students be informed
yes.
is a part of orientation process that that they can lose their they can be charged with a felony and lose their potential to be police officers or nurses or others where that be part of
they
an orientation
right
process
at the beginning before they to go to school for all those years and then they find out at the end they can't get a license because of prior mistakes.
I mean, we talked about adding that they could lose their student grants if they broke the law, if they were convicted of a felony. And then here is another. There may be a series of things that would really help students think about these kinds of things that we might think about adding. This piece of information that just emerged is a part of that orientation. Senator Tomasoni, you had another question?
I was just is it the same for an out-of-state student? Do you cross-reference whether or not they go back home and vote and then vote here also? Is there don't we control that?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, we don't.
Ms. Frazier?
We don't do that.
Right.
Would you like to have another testifier come forward at this time? We have Mr. Neumeister, who has requested to speak to this subject.
Someone could pass this out.
Someone here can help. You can just put it down. She'll put it up.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. And for those people who I may have not met or have not testified before, I'm someone who, for a great number of years, lobbies a lot on public accountability and openness in government, which I recently won an award for my decades of doing that here at the state legislature. The bill that before you, 661, has added something from judiciary, and that's about the University of Minnesota endowment. $400 million we're talking about. Secondly, it's right now being where they almost they had almost 45 minutes to an hour debate in subcommittee in data practices. So where I'm familiar with the process, you're all familiar with the process. So in full committee, the amendment, as it's still being worked on, was put on this piece. Now it's before you. This is not something that just should just, you know, be looked upon as, you know, an easy kind of decision. I want to illustrate some of the things, and once everyone has a handout, I'll go through some of those first of all. First of all, a handout which you have gives an idea a little bit of what the University of Minnesota does. They're going to have $400 million bucks, and what they'll do, they'll put it all in different venture capitals and limited partnerships in real estate interests, natural resource interests. What you will know, what you will get, are the names of those boxes, the VC, the limited partnerships. So it'll be ABC Limited Partnership, ABC Venture Capital, whatever it may be. Where you see the little boxes where the arrows are down, that is the information that would be non-public and which I have no problem with. One of the things that I also handed you is the Board of Investment language, which is 11A24. And if you look on page 2 of that side, things that are now public over at the Board of Investment is the funded amount of the state, right now is the market value of the investment by the state board's internal rate of return for the investment, and including expenditures and receipts used in the calculation of the investment's internal rate of return. That is now what is now public. That is the item, one of the crucial items that the university is asking to be non-public for their investments. So I think it's very important to be clear that we're having less public accountability, more secrecy, to where the public will not know how its money is being spent versus the Board of Investments in the same kind of things in capital ventures or limited partnerships or whatever it might be. The third item I handed out to you was a recent editorial, which I think gives some food for thought on some of those things. Now, why? Why is it important for the public to know what, at least a little bit more information than what the university wants? One of the things that we need to be aware of, if you take a look across the country with private equity funds, there are social concerns. You know, people want to know where money is being invested and what kinds of programs. Political concerns and ethical concerns. And even the current way of how there's some accountability, I think would raise some questions now based upon almost 45 minutes to an hour of testimony in the subcommittee of data practices, which is judiciary, and which they're going to continue this discussion of it tomorrow night. So that's one perspective. The other thing, I think, is if you look at other states, and there's a number of articles that have been done, and I've given some of those articles to at least the subcommittee on data practices I have not done here, raises the issues, well, maybe there should be disclosure. Maybe there should be at least public the names of the partners of those groups that I showed you here, of the VCs, LLCs, right there. Right now, I would go to the university under their proposal. I would not even know the names of the partners. Now, how they're presenting this to you is that under current law or the current concept, each individual of where they invest their $5 million in or $10 million in would be public. But what or their rate of return, you know, other kinds of things, how much they lost, the other things that they want to keep non-public. Now, they want to say to you, the public, to you, the legislature, or whatever, we don't want to do it that way. We want to just give you an overall cumulative. So you wouldn't know that one may have lost a lot of money versus one that maybe did or whatever. You could not see which ones are losers, which ones are winners, because you would only get a cumulative report back. So I'm just sharing with you, as you go, if you go into more of the details, and like even a senator asked a question because when the University of Minnesota responded about what kinds of accountability standards, well, we have a subcommittee of regents who look over investments, and they ask the questions, and they get a 70-page contract to review it and all that. And the senator, a senator asked the question, well, is the contract public? And at least to the best of my ability to that I remember, no. The contract that they have with the individual entity to give some accountability, to make sure that we're not putting investments in things that the public would not want, to make sure that there's some accountability and things are a little bit more open. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I wanted to share with you some perspective, some view. You know, I don't know what kind of action you may wish to take now, but I do think that there can be, when you do some comparison of states of Texas, California, even Illinois, which is a little bit closed than we are, and then California and Texas are, they give more information than what the U is proposing. So thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
And Madam Chair, we are, we'll be monitoring what the Data Privacy Committee, Subcommittee does so that we can incorporate their recommendations into the bill.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And I'm just trying to understand this. So if these little boxes that they're investing in, we all know what these are, but then we don't know, like if it's a mutual fund, is that what you're saying? We don't know who's all in their fund and the returns?
In the little boxes here, you won't necessarily know the type of things that they're going to invest in right here. Like if it's stem cell research or whatever it might be. You know, no one knows what they're going to put the $5 million, part, $2 million, $1 million, or whatever in. What you will know here where it says VC, LLC, you'll know the names of the company, but you will not know the rate of return that each of these little companies will get, like you would do with the Board of Investments. What the language is proposing, it's going to be a cumulative. It's going to be an overall report.
He's on with these four bullet points.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So would those be publicly traded companies, or
they're private. They're private equity.
Okay.
And I'm sure that the gentleman to my left could.
Mr. Mason.
Thank you. This chart is useful. It does describe the relationship of the University of Minnesota and a variety of different private investment companies. They're all general partners where we are a limited partner. So there is, as Rich has mentioned, an extensive contract between us that describes all of the socially responsible investing criteria that we might place on the investments that they make, all of the prohibitions against certain issues that we might choose to elaborate in the contract. And so there is
like
tobacco or arms dealing. I mean, it's a quite an extensive list.
Genocide.
What we are
Mason, is that not public? Is that contract?
The contract is not public.
Not public.
No.
So the public does not know those limitations that
no,
you place?
No, it is reviewed by the, there are several oversight and compliance monitoring processes at the university. First of all, the general counsel helps with the drafting of the contract. The regents gets a summary from the general counsel and from my office when we make the initial investment or get approval from the regents who are required to give us approval. So that would be one of the areas of discussion. This is currently what we do and what we would continue to do.
And Mr. Mason, is there a reason why that contract is not public?
Well, yes. The contract is one of a handful of pieces of information that describe the business, the way in which the business, let's use venture capital as an example because they're the most common. It describes how they operate. It describes who the individuals are, which are available on the website. We'd be happy to inform you of the website if you want to know who the limited partners are. But it also describes a variety of fees and other private company data. So it's really no different than us doing business with when we might sign a purchase contract with a vendor. We understand what the terms of the deal are, but we don't get the business underlying business information. We don't get their financial statements. We don't, you know, if as the university. And all of that information is described in these contracts. So they're very extensive. They go way beyond just the one-to-one relationship that we have. They describe the other limited partners' responsibilities as well, and who the other limited partners are is also very private and sensitive information. So it is for that reason, that would be one of the reasons, that we have pretty systematically been excluded from the better and the more successful of venture, buyout, and other private investors. Now, when Rich mentioned we'd only get you'd only get a vague summary, the legislation we've proposed suggests that you would know we'd cluster the venture capitalists, which might be six or eight, into a small sub-portfolio, and you would know how that portfolio is doing. You would not know how the individual ones are doing. In the history of the university, no one from Minnesota has ever asked for this information. This is not commonly sought information. It's very private. It's very detailed. It's very, it's extensive. And as I mentioned, we are being excluded from the better ones where the returns, all the good investment returns are. So there is a choice to be made here.
Mr. Mason, is the clustering that you're doing a way of protecting or giving enough of a shield in order for those venture capitalists to be, or limited partnerships to include you? Is that the reason for the clustering, is to give some degree of protection?
Yes, Madam Chair.
It can't be broken down enough to get specific information about specific organizations.
Yes, that's correct. And I also failed to mention in my presentation that the Newspaper Association has also reviewed our proposal and has no objection to it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
This goes back to Senator Wieger's point earlier, where the University of Minnesota has requested to comply with this subdivision. Why is it that we can't make the university comply with that subdivision, but we have to pass a law to allow you to do what you want to do in regards to these investments?
Mr. Niemeister.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, because they want to be different than the Board of Investment. The Board of Investment gives out more information publicly, and the university is interested to have their own little their little thing and more limited. I mean, that's the only.
Well, that's my point. If they're their own entity and they can do what they want and don't really have to listen to us, why do we have to actually pass legislation that allows them to do what they want?
Mr. Mason,
we have to comply with the State Data Practices Freedom of Information Act disclosure requirements. So in some instances, we are, in fact, a separate entity, but we are required to comply with the Data Practices Act.
So you still have to obey the law. Is that what
Senator Tomasoni? Senator Roebling?
Mr. Mason, if you were to follow the State Board of Investments requirements for public information, how many opportunities for investment do you think that would prevent you from having? And you would get a number, you would be able to close off a number of things that you currently might have, but there would still be some things that would be the same as the Board of Investments. So how would that impact you? How many business opportunities would you lose?
The Board of Investments operates on a different scale than we operate, and so their need in this regard is a little bit different. Their minimum investment commitment is $50 million. They typically prefer to make commitments of $100 million, and they have a limit of no more than 20% in any fund. So by virtue of that, they invest primarily, when they're investing in the private arenas, they invest in $1 billion and multi-billion-dollar funds. often $5 or $10 billion funds, of which they might be $250 million, would be typical. The investments that we invest, we typically invest $5, $10, in some cases as much as $20 million in an individual, but generally speaking $5 and $10 million in funds that are $250 million. It's the $250 million ones that are smaller, niche investments that have historically done better. They've produced better investment returns. And so that is why we focus on those. We've interviewed the top 10, or the top 20 venture capitalist funds. We're currently an investor in one, which is looking to exclude us at the moment. We were an investor in two others, which have already excluded us, and the other seven have said they would welcome our investment activity if we weren't subject to FOIA. They would love to have a better relationship with a big public university that is a major research institution, but FOIA stands in the way. And because they are so successful, they really have the pick of investors anywhere in the world. So even in times like this where everything is turned on its head, we are being systematically excluded from the best. In the venture capital community, which is the one that we've been referring to, if you invest in the top tier, the returns are pretty typical of some of the investments that we've made historically. The returns are anywhere from 30, 40, or 50% annually, in some cases much higher. If you invest in the next quartile, the returns are about what public stocks are, which in good times are 10 or 12% a year. The next two quartiles are negative returns. So it's imperative that if you're going to invest in this manner, as we hope to do, as the region's policy suggests we should, that we invest in this very narrow slice at the top. And those are the ones that are excluding us. The same case would be true with the better of the buyout funds and some of the distressed debt funds that are also private that we have some investments in. We're struggling to get into the top tier. And they would love to have the university an investor in their funds.
Mr. Niemeister, I think you wanted to say something. We'll take a few more questions, and we're coming close to the end of our time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to end by saying, even though no one has looked at it, doesn't mean that there should be a driving force to make it non-public or secret. One of the things, what the university is going through right now in terms of its doctors and its relationships, or the professors and their relationships, that's been hitting the paper the last few weeks, that wasn't learned until someone went and looked at the pharmacy data that no one really looks at, but found some ethical issues. So that's one of the things that I just bring to light here. Here are some, this is an issue, I think about it. There are some ways that you can do some things, and even though the comment is made, we talk to the companies, but what are the companies specifically want to be non-public? I've not heard that yet. And when I started to...
We've drafted the bill specifically to meet that. Well, exactly. I mean, very precisely.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, how much that is or what, I don't know. But the bottom line is that I would like to suggest that maybe at least the names of who's involved in those groups, the LLCs and the venture capitals, be made public. So at least people can see whether or not there are some folks who are, like the Bernie Madoffs, who are involved in public equities and things like that.
One more question, Senator Roebling.
Mr. Easton, I'm just wondering about other states and other public entities that are making these kinds of investments. Are we that much harsher than others, or are we comparable in our data privacy laws?
Mr. Mason.
We are similar for many large public universities, most of which have been with us, systematically excluded in recent years. Several other states are addressing the issue in some fashion, notably, as Rich has already mentioned, Texas, Florida, University of Michigan, Virginia, and California. So there is a move underway in some of those states to rectify or to change this issue. There's active discussion in most states, and all of those universities that the universities in those states that I mentioned have been excluded from the top tier of the private investment community.
Madam Chair, we need to.
Yeah, we do really need to. I think people are clear about what the conflict is, that there's an issue of a risk that comes with privacy, with this kind of private information. The lack of transparency may create issues in it against a need of the university to be able to invest in a way that gives them the best return on their investment, from which they'll be excluded without this. So I think with that, would you like to make a motion?
Well, Madam Chair, what I would like to do is I would like to move that Section 1, 2, and 4 be incorporated into the omnibus bill. That would be one motion. And then my second motion would be delete those sections from Senate File 6631 and send the remainder of the bill to the floor. Those are the sections that relate to the university or post-secondary institutions or students. Okay, so.
So we can begin with one motion.
Senator Roebling has a comment.
Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, I thought it was mentioned that this still is in the Judiciary Committee, so how does that work?
Well, it's just kind of tricky with the way that is, because what's going to happen is that section will stay here in the omnibus bill, and then any changes that they make in the Data Privacy Committee, they will transmit those changes to us informally, and we'll incorporate those by amendment. That's my agreement with the chair. Okay.
So the first motion will be to move sections 1, 2, and 4 to be included in the omnibus bill.
Yes.
Could,
Chair Roebling?
Could I make a motion that amendment that it could be possible inclusion?
Okay. That's fine.
For possible inclusion
that's
in the
fine.
Omnibus bill.
It's still a work in process. So.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 661 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor. Oh, excuse me. First, I would move to delete Section 1, 2, and 4.
There's a motion to delete Sections 1, 2, and 4. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Continue,
then I
Senator
would
Bappas?
Move to send Senate File 661 as amended to pass and re-referred to the floor.
Madam Chair, could I ask one question?
Yes,
no
Senator Senjum.
And I'm assuming this gets us back into the investment question. Is that right? Go to the floor?
No, it's going to stay here until, Senator Senjum, thank you, Madam Chair, until we find out what happens in data privacy. So Senator Roebling made the motion to keep it here.
And considering the omnibus bill, this motion is to move the rest of the language related to the students to the floor.
No, the rest of the language related to checking online to see if you're a registered voter, which we didn't discuss. The student stuff is also staying with us.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you for the clarification. Senator Senjum?
I'm not sure where we are, but could I just ask one yes or no question to the investment folks?
To Mr. Mason.
It may not be germane to where we are exactly. But
it's not, but
we'll re-clarify the motion. But, and we have to move along because we're...
I need is a yes or no.
Mr. Mason is approaching. Senator Senjum?
It was suggested that, I think it was suggested relative to this proposal, that it would be a proposal somewhat equal to what the State Board of Investments is currently doing, at least in terms of their parameters. Is that right or not right?
No.
Okay, that destroyed my question. Let me just ask, if the University of Minnesota was somehow or another, confidentiality or not, someone found out that the State Board investment, I believe, was involved in Iranian investments, and we have some sort of a bill around here. Were the university involved in something similar to that? Would that be public? Would somebody be able to find that and identify that kind of practice under your bill?
Mr. Mason?
No.
Okay. That's all I need.
Okay. Senator Pappas, would you restate your motion so we're clear about what it is?
I just lost my vote. Okay. Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 661 is amended to be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
On that motion, any further discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay, Madam Chair, we have one one quick bill. Where is it? 819. hold on. Let's have it here. There it is. Madam Chair, it just came to my knowledge that there's language in statute that says that a post-secondary institution cannot advertise or recruit students to participate in PSEO based on financial grounds. And it seems to me that that's a big deal, that we want students to take PSEO classes because it's going to save them money for college. So I would like to delete that language. The K-12 committee has asked for this, so they will review it as well, because I think it came from concerns that, you know, because the high schools have to pay the colleges for these PSEO classes. I think if we're going to move ahead with really PSEO, we're going to have to resolve this issue of the high schools and feeling like they're losing money on the deal. But I do want the, you know, I want students to know that they're going to save money in college by taking PSEO. So if there are no questions or comments, and since we're short on time.
Just real quick, is there anybody that has a question? Seeing no one, your motion would be to, is there anybody in the audience that wishes to be heard on this subject? Seeing none, Senator Pappas.
I move that Senate File 819 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the K-12 committee.
On that motion, any discussion?
You know what? Stop a minute.
Okay.
I'm sorry, we are in policy committee, so we have to refer it to finance. No, we don't, Mr. Fuller? We have to refer it where?
To the floor.
To K-12, because they have a policy committee
that's
too?
Finance. Yeah.
Okay.
E-12.
E-12. Thank you very much, Senator Wieger. Pretty soon it's going to be E-16. Senate File 819 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the E-12 policy committee.
Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
The meeting is adjourned.
You know what? Don't
meeting
adjourn.
Meeting is not adjourned.
Don't adjourn the meeting. Unadjourn the meeting.
Unadjourn.
Because I also want to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So in case they kill it, we still have it.
819. There's a motion to also
good flexible committee.
Include 819 in the omnibus bill. It'll be laid over to be included in the omnibus bill. Any discussion?
What?
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Yeah, let me just get a taste of it.
We are re-closed, or I think.
Adjourned.